Since President Donald Trump took office, about 1,300 National Institutes of Health employees have been laid off, and hundreds of NIH grants have been terminated. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss what those cuts mean for patients and for research on rare neurodegenerative diseases are Cure PSP Executive Director and Chief Science Officer Christoph Diaz. Welcome to the program, Christoph.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And patient Charmaine Kessinger. Thanks so much for being here, Charmaine.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Christoph, can you talk about what's happened with this federal pause in so much NIH funding?
Yeah, it's a complicated topic. And, you know, to kind of think a little bit about it from a listener point of view, a lot of research in the U.S. is supported directly by the NIH, and internally also the NIH is advancing a lot of important research. It's a very complex field, and a lot of the research that needs to be done might only have consequences or might only be applicable in, you know, 20 to 30 years, right? There's a lot of things we don't know in human biology and in many other aspects. And so NIH is a driving force for this investment. And so the proposed cut to the NIH just inherently just reduce a potential for innovation that these kind of early stage investment are driving. So just from a high level point of view, it's potentially going to slow down a lot of important work that are needed for many aspects of life, including when you think of neurodegeneration.
And Christoph, talk about the research that your organization does and what this pause has meant for your research.
Sure. I'm happy to, you know, I'll start by stating Cure PSP mission to contextualize what we do. We raise awareness, build community, improve care, and work together to find a cure for PSP, CBD, and MSA. And PSP, CBD, and MSA are three rare neurodegenerative diseases. PSP and CBD, from a scientific point of view, kind of resembles Alzheimer disease, but it's rare, not like Alzheimer, it's more frequent. And MSA resembles scientifically Parkinson, but it's also a rare disease. So if you think about research around rare diseases, even more tricky, right, to accelerate than diseases that are affecting a larger population. Understandably, priorities are focused on Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease because they're affecting, you know, millions of people in the U.S. and worldwide. And so rare disease are less, I would say, attractive to the regular kind of funding machinery that exists. And so NIH and other foundation, but primarily federal institution, are critical because they are also having special program to funding rare diseases. As far as direct effect on the current ecosystem, to me, the thing that I always mention is the uncertainty, right? A lot of these complex systems that are being supported by the NIH, university, public-private partnership, between a large university consortia and potentially private institution, they don't like uncertainty. They don't like to not know what's going to happen in the next 5 years for these type of funds that have been critical to their advancement and the growth of innovation. So we are a charity that funds about 5 million in program a year. So it's a drop in the bucket. Generally speaking, but at the same time, our strategy, and I'll get to your question there, is that we have small pilot grants that we are hoping to help early career scientists with a $100,000 grant to start a project in either PSP or CBD. And a success story for us is that when this pilot grant leads to enough data for the scientists to then apply to the NIH to get a much larger grant and continue their exploration and elucidation of these diseases. So that if that equation is no longer true, right, if our pilot grants are no longer able to then lead to much larger NIH funding, then our system needs to be reevaluated. So it's not affecting us right now, but the uncertainty is throwing a big wrench into the system that has been effectively creating new knowledge and eventually advancing new therapy that has been primarily supported by federal funding. Mm.
Yeah, because my understanding is roughly 800 grants have been canceled by the NIH. There's a proposed 40% cut in NIH funding. Charmaine, you have a rare neurodegenerative brain disease. Tell us about corticobasal syndrome.
Sure. It's called corticobasal syndrome or corticobasal degeneration. So back in 2021, I was at a friend's retirement party, and we got the pictures back, and my hand, my right hand, looked odd in every single picture. It made me concentrate on it a little bit more, and it's amazing how your body adjusts along the way. And it led me down the path of going to therapy because I was losing function in my right hand, in my right arm. Was odd. It felt odd. It moved odd. I wasn't able to tie my shoes. I couldn't figure out what was wrong. Great doctors, a great community here in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. Went to therapy, went to doctors, did a lot of tests, and then in 2024 was diagnosed with CBS.
Oh my goodness, so it took 3 years to get that figured out.
And if I'm understanding, and Dr. Diaz can correct me, it usually takes a really, really long time, sometimes 5 to 7 years, for someone to finally come to that diagnosis. And I have been very, very lucky to be able to have that figured out in a short period of time, once again, because of the good doctors that I went to. Mm. And a movement neurologist in Northern Kentucky, St. Elizabeth, is the one who diagnosed me. And it was just a shocking diagnosis. But you recuperate from that, and you think, okay, this is what I have. This is the things that I need to do. So I got my affairs in order. I'm donating my brain, and I do therapy and move forward. But let me just say one thing that Dr. Diaz said when we're talking about NIH. He mentioned things slow down, that the funding or the cuts are going to slow things down. I don't have that time. You know, I was diagnosed. It goes from the symptoms starting 4 years ago.
Yeah,
the time is clicking. Time is clicking for me. And I don't have that time. And that's why I depend on the federal government and NIH to fund things so we can move it along and try to find some cures.
What is your prognosis, Charmaine? I mean, I have to confess that before I started reading up for this discussion, I had never heard about CBD. So what does that mean for you when you get that diagnosis? What does that mean for your future?
Right. My doctor was point blank and provided information from me on the first, and then I did a research. And luckily, Cure PSP was right there on the internet for me to look at. They've provided a wide variety of resources to me, support groups. I've been very, very thankful. But my prognosis is that my doctor is saying it's going slowly for me. And my hope is that I will live for 10 years or even longer is my real hope. And I am progressing. My right arm is affected, and luckily I'm left-handed, and it's moving up my arm. The one thing I have to say is it makes you get clarity about your life really quickly. And I'm thankful for the friends and the support that I've had with my family and friends. I've lived a really good life and am living a good life, but I'm telling you, I moved up international traveling, higher up on my bucket list. So I just came back from Japan. I'm doing everything I can do within this next 10 years because I will slowly decline as time goes on.
Yeah. We're talking about how cuts to the NIH and a pause in NIH grant funding could affect patients and research. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Christoph, what are you hearing from patients like Charmaine? There must be a lot of concern and even fear out there.
So now, I just want to kind of recognize Charmaine for her courage, for talking so openly about our experience. And at Cure PSP, we're 100% dependent on our community and people with lived experience to raise awareness. So I just wanted to recognize her for that before I answer your question. So thank you, Charmaine, for your courage here. Charmaine, you mentioned this notion of, you know, taking many years to be able to get a diagnosis. And then just an example, right? So right now, these diseases, CBD and also PSP and MSA and others, are diagnosed by doctors eventually when they follow patients over time, when a patient detects a problem. And over time, that detection leads to more complex symptom. Eventually, by this hard elimination process, you have a doctor says, well, it might be CBD. So there's no blood test. There's no, you know, clear objective measure of the disease. And there's a lot of people trying to fund so-called biomarker discovery for these diseases. And the NIH is a huge supporter of these high-risk, but also high-reward type of exploratory projects. And in PSP, CBD, and MSA, there is a few, but not a lot of projects that are trying to elucidate biomarker. So that's a clear example of, you know, in order to help the population, we should have, you know, better tests, and the tests can only be supported, you know, by federal agencies. If you look at the history of Alzheimer's research, and just recently the FDA has cleared a commercially available test for Alzheimer's, if you go back in the past, this was all supported primarily in the pilot level by the NIH, right? So you're affecting all these critical progress that are needed to ameliorate the experience of those that are diagnosed with these diseases, as an example.
Mm-hmm. Charmaine, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I want to say that don't ever give up. In other words, I had really good doctors. My primary care doctor at St. Elizabeth, she listened to me. She said, okay, you don't think that's it? Then let's try this avenue. Let's get this test. Let's go here. Let's go to this neurologist. Let's go to therapy. I just want to say you keep going because you know your body and you know yourself. Keep going until you get the diagnosis that you think it is. And as soon as my doctor said CBS, I was like, that's it. Hmm. That's it.
You know your body and you have to advocate for yourself. Good advice. We'll continue this conversation after a short break, and later in the program, we'll hear about a Cincinnati boxer known as the Filipino Assassin. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about cuts at the National Institutes of Health and the impact those cuts are having on patients and research. My guests are Cure PSP Executive Director and Chief Science Officer Christoph Diaz and patient Charmaine Kessinger, who has a condition called cortical basal syndrome. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Christoph, before the break, Charmaine mentioned that she's made the decision to donate her brain for research after her death. There's been a lot of discussion about whether NIH should be funding indirect research costs versus direct costs. I want you to tell us what the difference is there and how something like organ donation figures into that.
Yeah, great question, and a complicated one. But I guess I'll start by explaining that if you think of a researcher applying to an NIH grant, right? Someone, let's say, was starting his or her lab, wanting to hire PhDs or postdocs or going to do their research, so like early career kind of a academic researcher, they're dependent on NIH funding for many aspects of their work. One, they're dependent to be able to pay for the salary or the reagents that they will need to bring on other PhD and postdoc, and then the reagents that these people will use for their research. But then there's also a lot of heavy equipment that are very expensive for research. If you think of advanced microscopes, they could be, you know, more than $1 million and even more. Things that are not that that exciting, like minus 80 freezers or complex equipment that are necessary for research. Those are often supported by indirect costs that a university in general also requests scientists to add to their applications. So when you it's hard to think of one without the other. So the direct costs are the costs that people are going to use directly for their proposed research. And the indirect costs are these hardware type of equipment, but also all the salary of the administrative staff and all the other people that are there to maintain these hardware. So just partial answer to your question, but that's one of the critical kind of a need that has been supported by NIH funding.
Sure. And those freezers that you mentioned are needed to, I mean, this is going to sound, I guess, kind of crass, but to store the organs that are donated, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm really glad Charmaine brought this up. If you think of any other diseases like cancer research, scientists can access tissue by taking a biopsy, right, of a patient and studying this tissue. In neurodegenerative disease and other brain diseases, we cannot access, right, fresh tissue because we cannot, you know, sample the brain without really impacting the patient. So most researchers, when they want to study the biology of these diseases, find indirect way to do so, or the only direct way to do so is to eventually rely on the dedication of a family to become a brain donor, which is even more complicated than just being a regular organ donor for all sorts of technical reasons. And these brains are then stored in many leading universities, including the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, with whom we work with, but also at Mount Sinai. There's a center here that specializes in rare diseases. So these brains are, carefully and lovingly processed by specialists that eventually store them in minus 80 freezers. And I have visited the freezer farm of the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, and it's a hurricane-proof giant building that has, hundreds of freezers that has inside it thousands of brains that then researchers around the world can access. And so the U.S. is a leading kind of stakeholder in this complex equation of studying neurobiology from brain. So these brains are distributed around the world. And so indirect costs, in addition to, philanthropic support and other private support, are directly involved in giving resources for these complex projects to be maintained in the long term. It literally is called a brain bank, right? So these banks are there for hopefully a long time.
Lucy, also, I'm doing everything I can do to keep myself alive as long as I can. I work out with a personal trainer 3 days a week. I go to Rock Steady once a week. I support groups. I go to my neurologist every 6 months. I'm active. I eat healthy. I do everything that I can do to support. Plus, on top of that, I donate. I volunteer. I do all the things that you need to do to try to have a good life and to continue my life as long as I can. I have an expectation, personally, that my government will assist me when I'm in trouble. If that's food stamps, if I need it. But for me, it's a rare disease that only 2,000 to 3,000 people have in the United States. And I want funding. Maybe it's a little selfish, but I want funding for NIH to try to move this along, try to get a cure, because it's going to take some time to do that.
Hmm. I wanted to react to Charmaine's point, if I may.
Sure.
The notion of selfish is not selfish at all, right? Because science, neurodegeneration has a lot of commonality between the different diseases. So if you think of Alzheimer's, right, which affects millions of people, or CBD, which affects, 2,000 to 3,000 people, the main protein that is involved, right, the main culprit, biochemically, it has a lot of commonality between the two diseases. So advancing research in cortical basal degeneration, in addition to helping you, Charmaine, and all those that will be diagnosed, will also help, the greater community, including those that are suffering Alzheimer or PSP, right? So investing in a rare disease or in a complex biological question really serves neurodegeneration as a whole. I just wanted to add that to your comment, which is on point.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very important. Charmaine, are you part of any clinical trials or research that are in limbo because of this pause, or is anyone in your network, the support groups that you're part of?
I have participated in actually Cure PSP's genetic study. And I'm getting ready to be interviewed for one that is a longitudinal study happening throughout the United States. And I'm sorry, I can't really talk about it specifically because I haven't been interviewed yet, but I'll do whatever, like I just said, I will do whatever it takes. If you want my blood, take it. You want my genes, take it. You want my brain when I die, take it. Do whatever you have to do in order for someone else not to be suffering from something like this.
Yeah. Christoph, for patients who are part of clinical trials or who are part of studies that the government has helped to fund, what impact can a pause have on them? I mean, earlier in our conversation, Charmaine said she doesn't have time to wait around.
Yeah, I always use that you know, the clock of this scientific discovery moves way slower than the clock of these diseases, so we don't have time, right? I'll give you a very pragmatic example, not of a disruption, but of bringing back this uncertainty issue. So not around cortical basal degeneration, but around PSP, and those two diseases have a very similar pathobiology that affects people with these diseases. The NIH funded it's a bit more than $70 million clinical trial to create a network of academic centers that will all coalesce around developing a clinical trial platform to support and test new treatment for PSP. So this is hosted at the University of California in San Francisco, and also MGH Hospital, Harvard Medical School, with many, many other centers. So this platform is attractive because, you know, industry could literally rent it or rent access to it to be able to de-risk or test some of their drugs in PSP. And if you think of the NIH in this case, is really the seed funder for this potentially transformational project. And you know, we are part of it. We are helping for recruitment and awareness of this project. So right now it's been funded, right? The first payment has been issued. The project is a go, but the uncertainty is probably creating a lot of doubt in potentially bigger partner from pharma companies that might wait and see if that funding is going to continue. We hope it continues. And to answer more bluntly to your question, if the funding for this clinical trial would stop, which we don't think it will, but if it were, it would be dramatic, right? It would be a really hard news for us to digest, because we are able to advancing, you know, new ways to potentially treat PSP at a cost that is much lesser than what it would take for a private company to do it on their own, and also creating more collaborative aspect around the data sharing and better practice for science. So that's a tangible example. We're very excited that this group got the funding, but now there is this question mark, is the funding going to continue? So that's one example that is affecting people as we speak.
Charmaine, what's your biggest long-term concern about this? These cuts to the NIH, these cuts to this research funding, when you think, you know, to the future, as far in the future as you think, what are your biggest concerns?
My biggest concern is that they're just going to stop it. And stop rare diseases like mine and others from affect children, affect adults, affect teens, that they're just going to stop or slow down. Because when they slow down, then that means that scientists go to other areas, possibly equipment goes to other areas, and then they have to gear back up. And again, that takes time. That talent is going to other places. It's important for things to stay steady and keep going forward and to accelerate from one disease, knowing about another disease, to another disease, to ultimately helping with CBS. Mm-hmm. It's just important to keep going and having the brains like Dr. Diaz and others to do that.
Christoph, what's your concern? Do you think this could mean the future of research? What do you think it could mean for the future of research generally in the U.S.? Could we end up training fewer talented scientists? Could PhDs end up going elsewhere to continue their work?
Yeah, it's you know, the U.S. has led innovation in biomedical research for a long time, and Emma, I always stay positive, right? In the work we do, we want to move forward. You know, neurodegeneration and science, they're not political, you know, issues, right? They're factual, they're real, it affects everybody. It's a bipartisan issue. So what I'm hoping is that eventually these uncertainties will be solved. And I don't have a clear solution, but in general, right, these diseases affect everyone. And I'm hoping that, you know, those involved in making this decision will eventually realize that. In the short term, hiring freeze has affected onboarding on new PhDs and postdocs, right? The current system of how innovation is being deployed academically has been paused to a certain extent. So that does create issues. And I have some anecdotal example of people rethinking their career, right? Either going to industry or going to communication or finding other way because they cannot pause their life, right? So I think there will be, I think the data will show that things have been slowed down, but I'm really hopeful that the U.S. will remain, right, this innovation kind of engine, but we have to raise awareness for it, and we have to let everyone know. And I'm really grateful to be able to speak about that on your show, and that Charmaine was able to also, you know, raise awareness for this important matter.
Thank you. I agree.
Well, I've been talking with Cure PSP Executive Director and Chief Science Officer Christoph Diaz and patient Charmaine Kessinger, who has a condition called cortical basal syndrome. Thank you both so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Very much appreciate it.
Up next, we'll hear the story of the Filipino assassin. This is Cincinnati Edition.